Oh, say can we see by the one light in all our earth to embrace at the call of all nations where our children can play in a world without war where we stand hand in hand in the grace of creation where the rivers run clean through the forests of green where the cities stand tall in the clear skies of freedom. Oh, say do our hearts sing out for harmony and love forever on the planet of our birth, blessed with peace on Earth.
Hello, and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us live at accesssacramento.org, or you can listen to this program and past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program includes about four different areas of discussion. The first one is Mark Hertzgard talks with Terrence McNally, who's a journalist and radio host. Mark Hertzgard is a fellow of the Open Society Institute, the nation's environmental correspondent. He has also covered climate change for 20 years and is the author of 6 books, including most recently Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. And then after that, from Living on Earth, The Cost of Coal. If the true cost of the full life cycle of coal were taken into account, this form of energy would be extremely expensive. In this program, they look into the extraction, processing, transportation, and combustion of coal that creates a large toll on the environment and human health. We also hear from poet and farmer Wendell Berry, who slept in the Kentucky governor's office to protest mountaintop removal. Host Bruce Gellerman also talks with Dr. Paul Epstein from Harvard University's Medical School about his new study measuring the true cost of coal. And then after that, the corruption game. Juan Cole, a professor of history and director of the Center for South Asian Studies at the University of Michigan, talks about U.S. government backing for corrupt dictatorships around the world. And after that, pressure cooking. Bill McKibben discusses the government's apathetic attitude towards global warming and that this forces the public to lead the fight against global warming.
The UN held its latest climate negotiations conference in Cancun in December, and today we're finally going to take a look at that conference in terms of the big picture. In his new book, today's guest, Mark Hertzgard, writes, quote, climate change is well underway, and we must begin to adapt to it, even as we work to stop it, unquote. For 20 years, Hertzgard investigated climate change, but it took the birth of his daughter, Chiara, to bring the truth home. Another revelation came when an expert advised that, without doubt, global warming had arrived more than 100 years earlier than expected. Nevertheless, in the book Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth, he delivers a message of hope to spur activism among readers. The traditional policy goal of halting global warming is more important than ever, but it must be pursued, he argues, even as societies prepare themselves for the substantial impacts that are now unavoidable. Adaptation to climate change is not a new concept, but Hertzgard's eyewitness reporting from around the world highlights its little understood implications for rich and poor alike. Mark Hertzgard, a fellow of the Open Society Institute, the nation's environmental correspondent, covers climate change for Vanity Fair, Time, and Die Zeit, and has written for many of the world's leading newspapers and magazines. He's the author of the highly acclaimed study of the media during the Reagan years on Bended Knee, as well as Earth Odyssey, A Day in the Life, The Eagle's Shadow, and his newest, Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Welcome again, Mark Hertzgard.
Thank you for having me, Terrence. It's good to speak with you again.
Yeah, good to hear you, Mark. As you know, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. And one point that I mentioned in the introduction really sets that up for you. You've stated that the birth of your daughter changed you and changed your message. Want to talk a little about that?
Sure. My daughter is now almost five, but this book began when she was only 5 months old in 2005. When I was on assignment for Vanity Fair magazine in London shortly after Hurricane Katrina, and I interviewed the chief science advisor to the British government, Sir David King, who was the one who pointed out some of the things you mentioned in your intro, that climate change, that global warming had triggered outright climate change and had done so 100 years earlier. And, of course, the terrible dilemma that arises from that is that once climate change has been triggered, you cannot turn it off quickly simply because of the physics and chemistry of the problem. Carbon dioxide in particular stays in the atmosphere for hundreds of years. So the upshot of what David King told me was that we were locked into 50 more years of rising temperatures on this planet no matter what, even if we did rather quickly kick the fossil fuel habit. And at that point, I was a very new father, and 5 months into a very changed way of looking at the world. And I remember leaving Sir David's office and walking down Victoria Street past the Parliament and over the Thames River as I was trying to grapple with all of this. And suddenly the idea struck me that, oh my gosh, Kiara has to live through this, has to live through the inevitability of 50 more years of rising temperatures and all of the climate impacts that that's going to bring. And I was literally staggered. And it was at that moment that I didn't know at that moment that I was going to write a book, but I decided that I had to do everything I could to help her and the rest of her generation try to find some way to cope.
Well, Mark, as I said, and as people have heard even on this program, you've been on this beat for a long time.
Yep.
And so that sentence you just said, I knew then that I had to do whatever I could. Had you not, you know what I mean, what shifted? Was it like you suddenly looked at what you'd been doing and realized it was not everything you could?
No, I feel like I had been doing everything I could, but what had shifted was the nature of the problem, really. I mean, by that time I'd covered global warming for 15 years, and throughout, beginning in 1989, and throughout the 1990s, the discussion around global warming centered around two questions. Is it real? And second, if it is real, what do we do about it? How do we turn off the rising temperatures and before it gets dangerous? How do we reduce greenhouse gas emissions enough? And those are the two questions. And what David King was telling me was that, no, unwittingly, humanity has now entered a new era of the global warming problem where it has already triggered outright climate change, irreversible climate change. And therefore, it's no longer just a question of turning down the heat, which, of course, we have to do. It's also having to live through what are now unavoidable impacts of a sizable nature.
As you just laid out, while you were covering it and while we were talking about whether it was real or not, global warming has begun. I want you to speak to one thing that you've already said, but it's that piece that I think a lot of people don't quite realize, which is the time lag between taking corrective action and the corrections actually happening up in the atmosphere.
I think you're absolutely right there. That has still not really sunk into people. When I talk to people about climate change at a, you know, at the grocery store or cocktail party or whatever, they are still caught in that first era mindset of, oh yeah, we've got to go solar, we've got to turn down the emissions. And of course we do. But what has not yet caught up to people is that the amount of carbon that's already up there has already made unavoidable a great deal of climate change. We are now locked into at least 3 feet of sea level rise, maybe as soon as the year 2050, certainly as soon as the year 2100. In California, that's going to be a major, major problem. 3 feet of sea level rise, I happen to live up in San Francisco, 3 feet of sea level rise is going to put San Francisco Airport underwater. The runways, the access roads on Highway 101. And so one local wag said, oh, well, the solution to that is very simple to climate change. It's just fly Oakland. But yeah.
Yeah, and you're going to lose Candlestick Park, but then they already built the new park.
Yeah, the new park, and Oakland's airport would also be underwater.
Ah, there you go.
So will the entrance ramps on the eastern side of the Bay Bridge. Down in your part of California, the port of Long Beach. LAX will be fine, but the port of Long Beach will be submerged.
And what's the date on that prediction?
That all depends. It could be as soon as 2050. 3 feet of sea level rise is the amount it will take to do all that. Comprehensive study done by the Pacific Institute for the state of California, and it was reported widely in the media, has all this data. But it depends how fast the sea level rises, and that in turn depends on our still imperfect scientific knowledge of how fast the polar ice sheets and snowpack and glaciers in general around the world will melt, thereby raising sea levels. And Lloyd's of London, the famed insurance company, says they expect 2 meters, that's about 7 feet, of sea level rise by the year 2100. If you map, dial that back, that suggests about 3 feet of sea level rise by the year 2050, when my beloved five-year-old daughter will be almost my age.
Mm. And again, just because I always want to make sure that the science makes some sense to people, the reason that even if we dialed back emissions, if we had started even at the right time, let's say, and had dialed back emissions to where we want them to be now, the persistence is because the atmospheric effects are inert, or because the changes that have happened will take that long to reverse themselves.
It's essentially for two reasons. It really is the chemistry and physics, basic laws of chemistry and physics, starting with the lifetime of a carbon dioxide
molecule
released into the atmosphere. Yeah. They remain in the atmosphere without breaking down for anywhere between decades and centuries, depending on certain technicalities. So they will be up there for a very long time, continuing to warm the atmosphere. The other greenhouse gases have much shorter times. Sometimes they're more potent in the short term, such as methane. But that's why carbon dioxide is such a worry to climate scientists, because it stays up there so long. The second major factor there, so that's a chemistry law, and then the second major factor is a law of physics, and that has to do with something we all learned in high school, I think, which is that warm water expands, takes up more volume, and specifically the oceans, as they warm, as the atmosphere warms, the oceans absorb much of that warming, and as the oceans absorb that warming and warm up themselves, they expand in size, and that is what assures that sea level rise has really the longest lag effect we're talking about here. That sea level rise, we're now locked into hundreds of years of sea level rise, and the question is, can we make that sea level rise go slow and limited enough to adapt to it?
You point out, I had made that comment, what if we had cut things to where we want them back at the start of this era? You make the point that 40% of humanity's total emissions of greenhouse gases during the Industrial Revolution have happened since June 23rd, 1988. Okay, 40% of all the emissions we've put out since the start of the Industrial Revolution have happened since that day in 88. What else happened in that day in 88, Mark?
That's the day that I date the beginning of the first era of global warming to. That's the day that NASA scientist James Hansen went to the United States Senate and testified that, in his opinion, as a chief climate scientist at NASA, that human activities were indeed raising temperatures on this planet. And that testimony, and crucially, the decision by the New York Times to put that story on the front page the next day, essentially put the world on notice that this was a problem, because when the piece ran in the Times on the front page, it immediately made global warming a household word in government ministries and newsrooms and living rooms, frankly, around the world. And so we were put on notice that this is a problem. And unfortunately, although there have been many, many subsequent scientific warnings in the years since, most governments, especially the United States government, have done very, very little to respond to this problem.
Now, one of the reasons that people don't respond is that there are other forces, short-term expectations, short-term effect forces that push against it. Now, you spend some of this book talking about some of that, the holding back that's been done by the deniers. And let me just read you a quote. You say, Washington journalists refer to deniers as climate skeptics. They're not skeptics. True skepticism is invaluable to the scientific method, but an honest skeptic can be persuaded by facts if they are sound. But these deniers?
These deniers are impervious to facts that don't fit their either economic or ideological agendas. They have decided that they don't want to believe in climate change because of what such a belief would imply, either for their sales and profits, if you're ExxonMobil or Peabody Coal, or if you are a member of the hard right new Republican majority in Congress. I think they are driven also by ideological reasons. They fear that if they accept climate science, that it will mean, therefore, more government intervention in the economy, more regulation, more taxes, etc. And because they oppose that on ideological grounds, they try to argue that the science is flawed.
Mm-hmm. Since the solution would necessitate, as you talked, probably regulation, intervention, and so on, then no matter what the cause of that is, it must be denied.
Yeah, but what's odd about that, Terrence, is that, you know, Republicans are the only conservative political party in the world who believe that. Go to Europe. In particular to Britain and Germany, our closest allies, or France, or Spain, or Italy, or the Netherlands, or Japan. No conservative political party any longer doubts the reality and soundness of climate science. They will argue about what you do about climate change, how, what policies do we use to attack it, who does what, who pays for it, all of that. But none of this anti-scientific rhetoric that you hear coming out of the Republicans in Washington about, oh, climate science is all a left-wing hoax. In fact, some of the most ambitious climate policies by any government in the world are being advanced by the conservative governments in Britain and Germany right now.
Right. By the way, another thing you point out, which I think many people probably miss, you say that Sir Nicholas Stern of the UK said in his 2006 study of the economics of climate change that climate change represented, here I'm going to quote him, the greatest, widest-ranging market failure ever seen. Because?
Because he would say that essentially polluters have been putting carbon dioxide up into the atmosphere for free. And that is a market failure because, in fact, putting that pollution up there imposes great costs on the rest of society in the form of heat waves, in the form of storms and flooding and drought that cost people their lives, that cost businesses their customers and sales, billions and billions and billions of dollars of cost. But because we don't put a price on carbon emissions, the market cannot take those costs into account, and polluters are free to dump their carbon in the atmosphere for nothing. And that, in the framework of a market economist, is a market failure.
Right. The market is supposed to, through prices, regulations, et cetera, incentivize, both deal with incentives and risks in a way that's good for what lies below or around the market, which is the society. And in this case, obviously, not at all. We're going to get into a number of things. One, we're going to get into what is happening in the world, and two, some action that you're encouraging. I want to deal just a little bit more with some of what's going on before we get to that. One of the things you say, and I think this is probably new to a lot of people, although you've pointed out some examples already when talking about the port of Los Angeles or the airport of San Francisco, etc. But you say
Long Beach, Terrence.
Oh, Los Angeles is on a different elevation.
Well, you don't have the same port. The port of Long Beach is what's in trouble.
Right, right. Okay. I know that, I've been down there. They touch each other, it's curious, but it must be the way the sea works. My research for this book has convinced me that even the wealthy, technologically advanced societies are going to find it enormously challenging to defend themselves. I think there are probably a lot of people that think it's going to be Bangladesh, it's going to be some islands, but not us.
I think that's exactly right, and that I would include among the people who believe that even many climate experts, because it was said through the 1990s when the denier lobby was trying to beat back any talk of reducing emissions, they said, look, We don't think that climate change is real science, but if we're wrong, no problem. We can always adapt to this. We're rich, and in fact, we should take that chance because if we learn in 50 years that this is a real problem, we'll be 50 years richer and we'll have more money to adapt. Well, that turns out to have been a very, very foolish position, and we learned that from none other than the country of the Netherlands, which is probably doing the greatest work on climate change adaptation in the world right now. And they are spending $1 billion a year to increase their sea defenses because, as is widely known, Netherlands is famously below sea level.
Right. So Netherlands is...
A storm there, they're in big trouble.
Right. Netherlands is that paradox here in that they're one of the countries most threatened, but they do have the resources and the wealth to deal with it.
Not just the resources and the wealth, because we'd have that, and most of Europe has that. What sets the Dutch apart is that they have a national commitment to do this, and they have a social context in which taking adaptation measures is supported by the populace. They had a government, they have a government system, where people accept the fact that taxes must be paid in order to be protected against flooding. And there is consensus, again, across the political spectrum that climate change is very real and poses a grave danger to the future of the Netherlands, so much so that the Netherlands has adopted a 200-year plan to adapt to climate change. They are spending approximately $1.5 billion a year on it right now, and they are making some very, very tough political decisions, including forcing some people to abandon property that they hold on the grounds that this is going to be too expensive for the society to defend. And they compensate those people, but they say, look, you have got to, we are not going to allow a business development right here on the coast because it's just too dangerous.
Mm. Thank you.
But now for something completely different.